Each failure is a step closer to success. You're listening to episode 1 of Learn With Us. I'm Ken.
And I'm Nikos. Learn With Us is a podcast for developers that want to learn how to teach programming.
Hey Nikos, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. How's yourself?
I'm doing wonderful. So I'm on the west coast of the United States, and where are you coming from?
I'm calling from central London.
Nice. So this is a weekly podcast, and what we'll be talking about is our experiences as trainers and teachers in software development. Nikos, what are you teaching right now?
Yeah, I'm working with a client, and I have around 8 developers within this client, and I'm teaching them basics of JavaScript and, you know, future JavaScript like ES6, ES7, and I'm also teaching them the Ember framework.
Cool. So have you had experience teaching Ember before?
I've taught it before when I was in another company where I had a junior developer that I was looking after.
Great. And what are the challenges with teaching a framework like Ember?
Well, I think you have to have a base level of JavaScript before. If you want to bring a whole class together with you on the journey, you really need to make sure they know the fundamentals of JavaScript really well.
One of the things that I've kind of had a passion for is teaching the core concepts of JavaScript and trying to drive interest around what JavaScript can give you out of the box rather than just jumping to a framework. Are you experiencing that? I mean, with what you just said, having those core skills before you jump into the framework is important. Are you seeing that as a benefit when you get into something like Ember?
Yeah, I find that my students really appreciate a strong foundation in JavaScript. It just gives them a lot more appreciation for the language itself, and I find that it helps them enjoy programming and JavaScript in general. And then from there, you can build on that and go into the framework.
Now, how far are you taking them before you jump into Ember? Are you getting them into features that are brand new, like arrow functions and async await and stuff like that? Are you getting them there before you jump into Ember, or are you kind of holding back on some of the features that are in the newer JavaScript?
Yeah, so I'm taking them through, you know, variables, operators, objects, arrays, promises. Then I'm going into ES6, arrow functions, object deconstruction, etc., etc. And then I'm teaching them some of the bread and butter skills like gulp, webpack, npm, those sort of things.
Yeah, those task runners like gulp and grunt and stuff like that. I feel like they're kind of losing out to webpack and just running, you know, transpilers, and I kind of wonder if there's still a need for things like gulp and grunt. Do you feel like in the training that you're doing that there's still a need for a task runner like that outside of running like an npm script?
Yeah, so I think in my training I'm only going to briefly cover, you know, gulp and grunt when I get to them with this class. Probably will focus more on webpack and also, you know, npm scripts.
So I started something this week, and I'm just kind of struggling getting it going. So I wanted to ask you something. When you first went out on your own and started going to get training, what did you do to drive interest into the things that you were creating?
Well, my classes are very interactive and hands-on. So what I do at the start of every lesson is give them some theory, whether it's on my laptop or a whiteboard, and then I'll either step through code that I have on screen or send them code for them to run on their own computer and then see how they're doing, walk around the class and check how they're understanding it. And then what I'll do is I'll just go through the material together. The students really enjoy that kind of, you know, two-way approach.
Rather than you just standing at a podium and talking to them, you give them something to work on and a goal to achieve.
Yeah, pretty much.
Great. So I wanted to. So what I started this week and it's just kind of getting going, is I launched my newsletter sign up form for TypeScript a day, and I was trying really hard to get, like, I had set a personal goal of saying I want to have 10 subscribers to my list every day, but I'm not even getting anywhere near that, right? So I total to date I have 14 subscribers, and that's over like 6 days of my thing being up and running. So I'm feeling like, how do I make a presence? How do I make people know about me and what I've got to offer? Is there anything that you've done that you said, hey, this actually got me some recognition or made me notable in this sort of way? Is there anything that you've done like that?
Well, I have a YouTube channel, and it's been running around 8 months now, and I think I've got about 150 subscribers. I think that you just really have to, whatever you do, is do something that you enjoy, and whether it's one person that listens to or, you know, 10,000, you know, put that same passion into the recording, and your followers will appreciate it, and you'll enjoy the experience. So I wouldn't really worry too much about numbers at the moment, because it takes time for, you know, an audience to find you and to trust you. But, you know, if content's quality, then, you know, word of mouth will be, you know, a good factor in growing your audience.
Yeah, I'm really hoping that once this thing launches, like, right now I'm just doing pre-launch signups and saying, hey, in June this thing's going to start. But once it starts, I hope that it just kind of takes off, and it's, like you said, word of mouth, and people will be, like, sharing my content. So I don't think there's anybody doing what I'm suggesting on doing. You know, it's not like I'm not doing charging a service. There's no fee for this. It's just, hey, sign up and I'll put great content in your inbox every day. So,
sounds like a great idea. You know, TypeScript's it was a bit of a niche technology the last, you know, few years, but now it's starting to get really into mainstream. You know, Angular adopting it, Ember's starting to, you know, write core parts of the framework in TypeScript, and even, you know, companies like Microsoft are using it for, like, you know, React based projects now.
Yeah. So Microsoft is using it on their Office 365 tools, and even Slack has written some of their web application in TypeScript, which is kind of interesting. A big company like that going for TypeScript. So yeah, I'm really excited. I don't think there's a lot of content out there with TypeScript, and I can see potential in creating content for TypeScript.
Yeah, and also I think Microsoft have something called React XP, which is like a React framework for native and desktop, and I think they're writing that in TypeScript. And also they've got a version of Create React App, which is also TypeScript, you know, friendly.
Yeah. Hey, that's a good segue. I was thinking of, you know, I write Angular apps. You primarily like to write vanilla JavaScript or vanilla TypeScript apps, correct? When you have to reach for a framework, do you go with just something that you already know, or do you look at, like, the capabilities of the frameworks that are out there before you get started?
Well, it depends what the client wants, really. You know, typically, I wouldn't really recommend a client to go and build a big, complicated web application using, you know, vanilla TypeScript. But I've got a lot of information on that on my GitHub. You know, a framework is, if you have like 3 or 4 developers and they all know a framework quite well, then I reckon they'd be able to, you know, churn out a web application quicker than just vanilla JavaScript developers, which is fine. But you can just do a combination of having a framework and vanilla JavaScript. So, for example, I write a lot of vanilla JavaScript components, but they're, you know, they can work with any framework. I have a React code generator app that I made, and I wanted to have like a growl notification thing on the app itself. So I just imported one of my own vanilla JavaScript components, vanilla TypeScript components, and then just dispatched events from React, and that that would actually interact with my vanilla TypeScript component.
Oh, that's neat. So the React way of handling that is, like, through Redux, you'd have some actions that would get triggered. And through those actions, you probably did your event bubbling. Is that kind of how it worked?
Yeah, pretty much. It's just sending events, you know, to the document where my TypeScript component was. A lot of times, it's not really vanilla. My vanilla TypeScript components that have the difficulty. It's frameworks components themselves that maybe that's where the difficulty lies. But I try and make all my components in vanilla TypeScript, you know, as framework agnostic as possible. Well, they're just really using DOM events.
Yeah, so you created a what was it? A space shooter? What game was that?
Oh, yeah, that's my HTML5 Space Invaders using TypeScript.
Yeah, and so that was vanilla TypeScript, no frameworks.
No framework at all. Didn't need a framework for that.
Yeah, and so how did you create you created everything in HTML and then used TypeScript to manipulate the DOM?
TypeScript was manipulating the canvas, all the games running inside of an HTML canvas.
And you have that, the whole creation of that app is on YouTube, right?
Yeah, there's like a 5-part series currently up there right now.
Cool. What's your YouTube channel?
It's called Quantum Information. Yeah, so it's just like YouTube /C/ Quantum Information.
In your training today, what are you working on?
Well, today I'm going to cover, well, I've actually called the class ES2015. So I'll just have a whole bunch of, you know, fancy examples using this latest syntax in JavaScript. And it's the fun thing is like, I don't even need to use like Webpack or Bible for this class, because most of the stuff just runs in Chrome now anyway, without transpilers, which is really great.
Yeah, a lot of times I'll open up a code pen and just start hacking away and realizing I don't need to have Babel set as my transpiler, because Chrome will just runs all the latest. I do a lot of node work anyway, so I kind of am familiar with what V8 has to offer, and V8 is the Chrome JavaScript engine.
Yeah, Chrome is just so mainstream now. It's just, sometimes I wonder if we won't need to have like IDEs. We'll just develop inside of Chrome, because, you know, you can do like Command O and that'll show you all the files. You can do like Command Shift F on the Chrome and the Mac, and that'll, you know, do a deep text search like you can do in WebStorm. You know, there's even dark theme now. If you can do like, I think it's Command P on Chrome, you can just, there's so many things that Chrome can do for developers. It's becoming more and more like an IDE.
Yeah, no, the dev tools are amazing in Chrome. So I just recently switched my default browser to Firefox, and I'm trying to live with it and see how it works. I took the recommendation from another podcast, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna try something new. I'm gonna get out of my comfort zone and try Firefox and see if I like it. I did take a quick step over and try the Brave browser too before I switched to Firefox, which, you know, I like the idea of, you know, privacy in the browser baked in by default, but it just seemed a little bit too restrictive. And then a lot of the things like Java doesn't work in Brave. Some other things don't work in Brave, but it's kind of how you'd expect a privacy browser to work. So.
Chrome is definitely have things like JavaScript and cookies turned off by default there in Brave.
No, JavaScript's not turned off by default, and cookies. I think they'll allow cookies as long as they're served from a secure source. I don't know for sure, honestly, but it just seemed a little bit too restrictive for me out of the box. So it's still installed, but not using it. All right, so ES 2015. So I wrote a course on Treehouse on ES 2015. I'm going to say about a year ago. And just last week, I kind of went on a little Twitter rant and I'm still not sold on the naming conventions that are portrayed in JavaScript. Have you had any pushback from your students or any questions from your students like, hey, why are we calling this ES 2015? Isn't this just JavaScript?
Not yet. I mean, it is a bit confusing. You know, you have to just Google it and see, you know, what is what. You know, for a while, I thought ES 2015 was something, you know, like ES 7 or 8, but then I, you know, realized that it was just another word for ES 6.
Yeah, so ES 6 turned into, just before it got kind of pushed out, it got turned into ES 2015, and then ES 2016 was turned into ES 7. ES 7 was turned into ES 2016, which I get it. I get it from the standards body, the TC39. I get it from that standpoint. Like, internally, let's talk about it, like, as in the version number in which we're going to release. Because browsers ship at different intervals and different cadences, you don't know what's going to land and when it's going to land. Like, even if ES 2017 ships today, all of the features that are in ES 2017 might not be alive in any of the browsers when ES 2017 is finalized. Like, so it doesn't really matter to the browser vendors. Like, it's a thing, but it's not the thing us developers really need to be hanging our hat on. So I've kind of been forcing myself to stop saying ES 2015, and saying, hey, it's JavaScript. We're going to write JavaScript, and we might need a transpiler, and this is why we might need a transpiler.
Yeah, sometimes I'm not sure whether, you know, the ES 2015, or just call it ES6, will actually run in Chrome. Sometimes you have to just keep checking the tables to see what's enabled.
Yeah, so where have you gone to look up that information?
I only tend to look up if, like, some error is thrown in the Chrome console, but so far most of the stuff I've written in ES6 has worked in Chrome.
Yeah, so there's a really cool website that I like to follow, but I mostly like it because it tells me which version of Node has the specific feature that I'm looking for enabled. So if you go to node.green, that website will tell you specific features that are available in a particular version.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that one. That's really nice, that one, yeah.
There's other... I think Can I Use has some stuff that's specific to browsers. Can I Use? But it's more about the browser, what the browser's capable of, CSS, HTML, and JavaScript.
It's almost impossible to memorize or to know all these different things that ES6 does. There's some of them I've never even heard of, you know.
But yeah, so I've been a little bit disenchanted with the naming system. So I'm hoping that as this year comes to an end, like we're halfway through the year, I hope by the end of 2017 that the the JavaScript community can just say, hey, it's going to be like this every year. Let's just start calling it JavaScript and not polluting the interwebs with these names that really don't mean anything except for the people that are developing the features.
Yeah, that's a great idea, I think.
So, I'm hopeful that that will change. You know, I'm starting the call to arms and hoping that people will follow me, but, you know, not sure that's going to happen. But, hey, here's to hoping.
Another thought I had, do you see the lines between JavaScript and TypeScript beginning to merge?
So I kind of see it happening, but I don't think it's going to go away entirely. I don't think TypeScript is going to just overcome JavaScript, and that's what everybody will be writing. And at the same time, I look at what FlowType is doing, and I think, well, which one's better? I feel the tooling around TypeScript is better, and developer comfort is better in TypeScript. However, I see Flow being more cross compatible, where you know it's more comment based, JS doc esque. So I can kind of feel like more people will eventually kind of grab on to Flow. Now, if the tooling ecosystem comes up around Flow to match what TypeScript have, you know, we could have a completely different opinion on things. Like TypeScript might just say, no, this Flow is great, do it, you know. And I think the TypeScript team's okay with, you know, competition. They don't even consider it competition. They consider it, hey, teamwork. We're going to work together. We're going to build a better environment for developers. So I'm not certain that TypeScript is going to become what JavaScript, or JavaScript is going to become what TypeScript is, but I see that things are getting better over time, and writing JavaScript is going to become easier.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing for me in TypeScript is definitely the types, surprisingly. So, you know, one day if JavaScript decides to implement typings like TypeScript has, then there'll be even more of a bigger question.
Yeah, I mean, when it all comes down to it, it's the compile process of TypeScript is what saves you every time, right? So, like, if TypeScript won't compile, you know there's a problem. And because JavaScript is so dynamic, it doesn't really happen until runtime, right? It's so... The compiler is the tool that we really need, and whether it's TypeScript or Flow or Babel, it's just as long as something is grabbing that code before you push it up to your server and running it and doing some processing on it, that's the piece that we need. And TypeScript does it so well in the browser or in your editor, whether it's an IDE or even Visual Studio Code or Atom. You have that tooling at your fingertips, and I think that's so great, and it makes developers more productive, and new developers feel more confident about the code that they're writing.
Yeah, I think we both, as TypeScript users, we like it not because it's, you know, a Microsoft product, but because it's a great tool. That's why we use it.
Yeah, I mean, when I saw it, my first take on it was like, oh, that's complicated. I don't really want to touch it. Once you start using it, once you get the initial, like, that hurdle of getting everything installed and getting your environment set up, and to be honest, that's, to me, now that I've done this so many times, it's so simple. Like, install Node, install TypeScript, open your editor, and you're good. Like, there's really nothing else you need other than telling your editor, hey, this is my language service that I want to add. Like, for you, you use WebStorm, so you need to tell it, hey, I'm using TypeScript in this project. I use Visual Studio Code, or I use Visual Studio, which both of those have TypeScript baked in from the get-go. Granted, I think Visual Studio, you have to install the TypeScript extension, but it's everything's there and ready for you, and it's like a first-class citizen, so... Not everybody has it that easy.
Yeah. Like WebStorm, it kind of like asks you, do you want to compile this thing on the fly? But I always say no, and I just have Webpack running a watch on top of my, you know, the entry point for the TypeScript application. And then my IDE still supports all the, you know, type checking and stuff.
Yeah, the language service is running. Every keystroke, you've got type checking. Yeah, Visual Studio Code is very similar in that regard, because you can tell it, you can create a task in Visual Studio Code that will do that compilation on save thing, but it's not turned on by default. You have to configure it that way. And then I do the same thing. I'll tell Webpack to watch a project. So, so you're teaching ES 2015, and what are you hoping to have done by the end of this week? Where are you hoping to be with your class?
Well, by the end of this week, I really want them to understand what arrow functions are, because we'll be using them a lot in the future. That's pretty much my main goal right now, is just to have them comfortable with arrow functions. It's pretty much the most widely used of all the ES6 features. And then I just want to make sure they understand promises, which I find takes a bit of time, a bit of repeating, and also browser events, bubbling, capturing. And then hopefully we'll take them into, you know, basics of Ember, you know, soon.
Cool. So on the topic of arrow functions, do you teach them about, hey, when do you use an arrow function versus when do you use an anonymous function and a named function? Do you give them like the comparisons of like, this is, you'd use, if you were in a callback environment, you'd use an anonymous function. Or if you were using promises, you'd use an arrow function, and kind of show them the benefits of one over the other?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, callbacks, you can use named functions as well if you like, if you want to have, because sometimes people prefer to have named functions just for error checking, you know.
Right. You'll get the name of the function in the throw or in the call stack.
But I just want to get them really comfortable with the, you know, the scope of this being set to, you know, the callee scope, which is saves you having to write things like this, you know, self equals this and all that stuff. So, yeah, and I just want to teach them about, you know, how to use, you know, arrow functions in like a maps or arrays, and just how it saves you having to write, you know, extra keystrokes just to get stuff like one parameter and one return.
The implicit return of an arrow function. Yeah, there's so much going on with an arrow function that I think it does deserve a good amount of attention. So that's it's interesting that you're giving it as much attention as probably I would. I'm glad of that.
I mean, arrow functions are just really great. You know, if you want to handle events and things, you don't have to bother about worrying too much about this. You know, it's great.
Yeah. No, yeah, exactly. The only time that an arrow function doesn't perform the way you think it might is when it's in a callback and you're like, well, wait, what context am I in? And like, you have to know that function that you handed the callback is not going to happen in the same scope that you originally thought it was. Cool. Well, I think we're getting back. We're getting up to a half hour now. So, I think this is a good first episode. We've talked about what we're doing, and I think, you know, for next week, we'll just check in and see how everything went with your class and
Sounds
how everything's
good.
Going with my newsletter sign up. Hopefully, I'll get some subscribers. I'm not gonna hold my breath. But, you know, 14 subscribers in the first week is pretty decent, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I'd love to be so happy with that.
Thanks for listening to Learn With Us. Please rate the show on iTunes. We only take 5 stars, so there's no score less than 5 stars.
Yeah.
This is our first episode, so we hope to be back next week. And thanks so much.
Thanks for joining us.